The picture I promised is indeed there. I cropped it while I was talking with James and actually sent it up. And if you look carefully, you'll see regular at $2.99. Or is it, $2.99, unleaded at $3.09, Supreme or Premium at $3.19. Well, unusual. It's in the desert, of course, so it's a little higher. But those were the prices about a week ago. Now, those are big prices, really big prices. What percentage of oil, James, do we import right now?
About two-thirds, maybe even closer to three-quarters.
Wow.
We use about 20 million barrels a day, and that means every 5 days we use 100 million barrels a day.
God.
Every 5 days.
And two-thirds are better imported.
Yeah. We use about every 50 days we use 1,000 million barrels. That's a billion barrels.
Billion barrels.
And every 350 days we use 7 billion barrels of oil. The United States has remaining about 28 billion barrels of crude, of conventional crude oil. And so if you do the math, you'll see that we don't have a whole lot based on the fact that we use about 7 billion barrels a year. There's about 28 billion in the ground.
Worldwide, I wonder what percentage come from people that hate us.
Well, I think about 20% comes from the from Saudi Arabia, and a lot of the other. We get a lot of our oil in the United States from Venezuela, mm-hmm. despite the fact that we've tried to kill Hugo Chavez a couple of times and he hates us.
Mm-hmm.
The old saying is that oil is fungible. Meaning that, oil produced in Nigeria finds its way into markets all over the place. And I think that that's true to a certain extent.
It's a world oil market, right?
Yeah, it is a world market. What we're seeing, really, you said we were in the long emergency. I would say we are about to enter the long emergency. We are, and one of the first signs is that we're seeing the energy markets wobble.
We're also seeing the automakers wobble a little in the U.S. I mean, this most recent price hike in the price of oil has... I saw this story the other day, I don't know if it's true or false, indicating that the bonds of some of the automakers were derated by at least one agency that derates these kinds of things. Is that really going on? I mean, the fact they're producing all these SUVs, are they that hurt just by this little price hike?
Well, they are hurt, although General Motors and Ford have been on the ropes for a lot of other reasons. You know, General Motors, for one, has not been making any profit off of automobile manufacturing for a long time. They make their profit, whatever profit they make, off of activities like money lending. GMAC, the financial entity that lends money to buyers.
They don't make money on cars?
Not really, not on production. They have tended not to. But it certainly isn't going to help them that they are all tooled up to produce nothing but large SUVs, and there are going to be fewer and fewer people asking for them. And, of course, as we know from our last go-around in the 1970s, you know, when you tool up these enormous factories to these systems to produce a certain kind of product, it takes quite a bit of change and time to retool the factories to bring out a different kind of product.
Don't you wonder, James, why they apparently did not learn anything from the 70s? I mean, they had to be able to see what you can clearly see is ahead.
Well, it was a slow process, and, you know, we're talking about a 30-year process, and I think it's pretty clear what happened, is that after the mid-1980s, when the price of oil started heading way down again, when the North Sea and the North Slope of Alaska came into full production, Americans sort of lost interest in economical cars. And General Motors, you know, slowly but surely, and Ford started producing large SUV-type cars based on their truck chassis, their pickup truck chassis. And they were popular. They were a big hit. And what really sealed it for them was the fact that they made a much, you know, whatever profits they were making at the time, they were making much higher profits off of these large vehicles than they were off the little vehicles per unit.
To be fair to them, I guess they've got to produce what we want.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
And so back then, they decided that it was in their interest to do this. And they've just been sort of sleepwalking through the car industry the same way that the public's been sleepwalking through the last 10 years of American life.
Mm-hmm. What was the Iraq War about?
The Iraq War was an attempt to set up a police station, an American police station, in a very unstable and very strategically important part of the world that we were desperate to stabilize.
And we're desperate to stabilize it because?
Well, because the Middle East is where two-thirds of the remaining oil in the world is.
Bingo. I believe every American president of recent vintage historically has said we would, if necessary, go to war, meaning even nuclear conflict, to protect the access to and from the Persian Gulf, right?
Well, it was pretty much the Carter Doctrine. Jimmy Carter defined this doctrine, which said that declared that the Middle East was an important strategic area to the United States, and that we would do what was necessary to secure its stability. And that's pretty much exactly what we did. Secondarily, the Iraq War was prosecuted to moderate and influence the behavior of the states adjoining Iraq, namely Iran and Saudi Arabia.
Syria.
Syria too, the Emirates, all the states down there, but principally Iran and Saudi Arabia, because they're two of the most important oil producers in the world.
Is it working?
I'd say that it has worked to the degree that the whole region hasn't exploded over the last 4 years. Is it a project that we can feel confident about in the long run? I don't think so. You have to ask yourself, how many years can we remain occupying an unfriendly country, or more than one of them?
Well, it began as a very popular effort. The latest survey that was on CNN the other day indicated 52% of the American people now feel negative toward what we're doing there.
Well, that figure is liable to go up. I hasten to add, whatever the polls say, it does not alter the strategic reasons for our being there.
Mm-hmm.
And, one of the things that the American public, I think, struggles with is the notion that whether they approve of things or not, whether those things are necessary.
In a way, this was necessary, right?
Well, it was necessary if we wanted that part of the world to remain stable.
Well, we do.
Kind of spinning out of control. And, it was a desperate attempt also to keep the United States, life in the United States, stable, because, we have this enormous kind of economic system cranked up that depends utterly on reliable oil production from that part of the world.
And for how much longer do you think that's going to remain reliable? Either way you look at it, from a political point of view, or even just how much oil is really left, and at what price, more importantly?
There are a couple of things you'd have to look at. One is, of course, what we were just talking about. How long, how many years can the United States occupy unfriendly nations, and how many can we occupy at a time?
Mm-hmm.
And how successful can that venture be? Obviously, we're not having an easy time of it in Iraq, and sooner or later, we're going to have to get out of there one way or the other, whether we establish this successful democratic regime or not. All bets are off, really, for Saudi Arabia. Anything could happen there at any time. Somebody could walk into Prince Bandar's office with a cell phone loaded with plastic explosive and You know, that would be the end of a large percentage of our oil imports right there. There's also no telling what will happen with the infrastructure of oil, namely the wells, the terminals, the refineries, the pipelines, all of this rather delicate, soft, these delicate, soft targets that are all over the area that so far have not been destroyed, but could be fairly easily.
All right. I had a caller in the first hour who was complaining about the oil company profits. How, you know, as you're looking at this at the economic side of things,
yeah,
how big a factor is the percentage of profit they're making during all of this?
Well, I tend to be allergic to conspiracy theories. So despite the fact that the oil companies are profiting from the current high prices, I don't see that as particularly significant. I don't see that giving us really a lot of information about what's going on. You know, we are at peak, meaning there's still a lot of oil in the world, and there's still a lot of it flowing and moving around. And for now, it is still flowing and moving around through fairly stable markets. Nothing has really fallen apart yet. Nothing has really kind of wobbled too badly yet. So this is precisely that part of the process when the oil companies are going to do best. There are some things we can observe about the oil industry, though, that are somewhat telling. They are taking their enormous profits, and they're not putting it back into exploration and drilling.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it?
Right. They are buying back their own stock and using their profits to buy other companies and merge with them, which, by the way, has the result of eventually getting rid of a lot of employees.
Which you would imagine indicates they clearly see the writing on the wall that we don't.
Well, what they're seeing is that this is a contracting industry.
Yes.
On the whole, in the macro sense, that oil production and oil drilling is an industry in decline.
That's a very good point.
So they're not making any new investments in trying to find new oil. And the reason that they're not trying to do it is that we have good reason to believe that most of the great discoveries have been made and that very little remains to be discovered in places where it is economically recoverable. We know that the United States has been searched, you know, up and down. It may be counterintuitive, but the fact is that the former Soviet Union, now Russia, and even China have been relentlessly and remorselessly searched by their respective state oil companies because they didn't have to justify it economically. You know, they could drill wherever they wanted. They didn't have to report back to stockholders.
Quite true.
And tell them whether it was worthwhile or not. So they drilled relentlessly in all these remote parts of Asia, including Siberia, and they found what they found. But it isn't likely that they're going to find any major new strikes. That's really where we're at now in the oil industry.
All right, so here we are, just about at peak. A few years ago, I was lucky to visit China, James, and I got up into Shenzhen, the economic area in China, and even those years ago, and that was quite a number of years ago now, I was stopped dead cold. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I passed miles and miles and miles of factories. It was kind of like the old industrial U.S. Mm-hmm. The roads were absolutely choked. The air was foul. Trucks were everywhere. The economic activity was unbelievable. And now years have passed, and it's grown by leaps and bounds. So the energy demands from China are bound to be astronomical.
Well, they did pass Japan last year as the world's second largest consumer of oil. They don't have that much of their own. They have, I think, slightly less than we do, and they are cranking up this enormous oil-based economy. I tend to refer to it as the last great industrial economy. They've started relatively late. You know, a lot of people regard China as the coming great giant dragon of the 21st century, and I have reservations about that. They are a nation. For all their current power and the great leaps that they've made in the last 20, 30 years in cranking up their economy, they are a society which is afflicted by tremendous ecological problems, by orders of magnitude greater than anything we have here or can imagine.
Right.
You know, tremendous problems with fresh water. Their water tables in the grain-growing regions of North China are retreating by about 10 feet a year, and their grain crops, their crop yields are heading south at a substantial rate. So they're going to be net importers of food very soon, if not already.
And energy. So
they have tremendous energy needs and problems. And you have to ask yourself, of course, when does China start reaching out for energy resources? And I think the answer is they have been very quietly and carefully reaching out over the last couple of years. They've been making contracts with nations like Venezuela and Canada, and they are doing civil engineering projects all over Africa and the Middle East, trying to curry favor with the various nations there. And, you know, to a certain extent, it's just sort of a practical business thing. A point may come when a nation like Saudi Arabia will say, well, you know, we've had all this trouble with the Americans, and they try to control us, and we have these cultural problems with them and these religious differences, and here come the Chinese, and they want to buy as much oil as we can sell them. Why don't we just sell them our oil and not have these cultural problems we're having with America? And political problems.
I hadn't thought of that.
Well, I think that you could say it another way, too, is that, you know, China is very close geographically, to many of the oil-producing parts of the world. They can literally walk into places like Kazakhstan. And you have to ask yourself, will they do it? Or will they even just extend their influence there? Or how far will they seek to extend their influence? Might they invite some of the Arab states under the protection of their nuclear umbrella and say, look, you know, you guys were protected by the Americans for 50 years. Why don't you try being protected by us now?
Yes.
You know, we have weapons that are very potent, and we'll be good customers for you. So come under our tent for a while. And I think that that's sort of the expectation for the next 10 years.
God, I hadn't thought of any of this, but I'm sure to the Saudis, the Chinese would be considerably, I don't know, a more comfortable sell. If they're going to get the same money and virtually the same protection, then you're right. Why not make the switch?
Yeah, well, it also brings us back to this question of the United States. And realistically, how long can we afford to continue to occupy physically these countries where they're trying to blow up our soldiers every day and succeeding.
Yes.
And it's costing us $80 to $100 billion a year to do it. How long can we do that? And you know, if you think about it for a while, it's hard not to come to the conclusion sooner or later that America may have to withdraw back into the Western Hemisphere. Sooner or later.
James, hold it right there. We're at the top of the hour. James Howard Kunstler is our guest. We're talking about the book and his article in Rolling Stone, The Long Emergency. From the